The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to documentary filmmaker Jeremy Wheelahan, whose new production is now in the wings on a world stage. It's a fairly unambitious idea. He follows Kevin Spacey and Sam Mendes through the Bridge Project Company production and world tour of Richard III. Stick around and talk about a house of cards. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you preferred to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of equity card-carrying Shakespearean actors who don't approve of anyone's version of the Bard that they're not in, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Have you seen House of Cards? Kevin Spacey is so deliciously creepy in this Netflix series that I simply can't imagine being around him for more than a few minutes at a time. Of course, I felt that way after The Usual Suspects and then American Beauty, too. But that's just me. Jeremy Wheelahan obviously doesn't share my unease, having worked with Spacey on and off over 20 years. So the idea of shooting a documentary film about a live, modern, year-long touring production of Shakespeare's Richard III that was the first reunion of Spacey and Sam Mendes since American Beauty was clearly irresistible to him. Now, in the wings on a world stage, is an extraordinary documenting of Spacey as Richard and much more. Wheelahan gives the viewer unprecedented backstage access to the entire cast as the play is in development and as it winds its way around the world, through big outdoor venues and relatively intimate indoor ones. And Wheelahan, who spent 3 seasons as associate director of London's Old Vic Theatre Company, where Spacey himself has been artistic director for many years, has an excellent sense of what even the casual theatergoer's mind would find awe in. And you need not know a thing about Richard III or Shakespeare to enjoy this documentary, now available on Netflix and Amazon following its theatrical run. Jeremy Wheelahan, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. Good to be here.
Glad to have you. So let's start with the essential question. Kevin Spacey. Crazy motherfucker or the most misunderstood genius in show business?
well, that's quite a question. Possibly misunderstood, but I don't know if he's misunderstood. I mean, he's sort of all over it, Kevin. He's, you know, he's quite mysterious. I'll give you that much. And he's very much an actor who appears in sort of on every front, really, whether it's film. This work on Netflix with House of Cards, or recently I believe he did a video game, computer game. So he's pretty ubiquitous these days. He is everywhere, and I think he very brilliantly over the course of his career seems to have sort of cultivated a sort of very private and sort of somewhat enigmatic presence in the media world. So it was quite interesting to set about working with him and making a documentary, which would follow him for the best part of a year while he's at work in the theater, in the dressing room, and touring to all these countries. But you know, he's a brilliantly talented actor, Kevin. He's a very, very successful and powerful figure in the entertainment industry, and also I think quite influential, and seems to find himself more often than not on the sort of front of the wave of innovation, really, whether technological innovation like this Netflix sort of arrangement with House of Cards, or you know, whether it's at the Old Vic Theatre treading the boards or running a theatre company in Ireland, or you know, his very highly acclaimed and for what he's most famous, I suspect, his film career. You know, so he's a complicated, dynamic, and pretty prodigious fella, that's for sure. And it was fascinating to follow him with a camera for so long, but fortunately, I think that was facilitated by a very long-standing sort of working relationship that he and I have sort of evolved over the past 15, 20 years.
Well, when you were mentioning all of his variety of talents and things he's done, you missed the one that I saw last week completely by accident on Facebook. Apparently there's a video clip of him playing the harmonica with Billy Joel and a all-star cast on stage. And it's just like, what in the world? What can this guy not do? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, he is amazing. I mean, he's got many, many talents, and it isn't limited to just acting. I mean, he can sing. I worked on a film with him in 2003, 2004, which was a biopic of the singer Bobby Darin, and he sang all the music for that. The soundtrack of which was nominated, I think, for a Grammy. He did a tour then with a full big band and the whole bells and whistles, and toured the US and some other places. He's known to wheel out an incredibly astute sort of impersonation, or you know, I mean, he's a brilliantly talented and gifted performer, Kevin, and he likes to explore that, I think, in every way that he possibly can, and he's not afraid to do that, whether on stage or in film or in television or online or wherever it goes, you know. And I think people really respond to that, you know.
So as much time as you've spent with him leading up to this project, you decided, well, I mean, you were comfortable with spending this much time following him around with a camera, that you didn't have concerns about that he might not be comfortable with that much exposure, for example, or that he would be a good candidate. I mean, a year is a long time to be in and out of somebody's life with a camera.
It's true. I mean, you know, of course, and I think not just Kevin, but the rest of the company, the other 19 actors who were there, part of this company, and the crew and everybody else. I mean, I think, I suspect any filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, who's going into such an intimate environment and a professional environment, a working environment and creative environment with Kevin and with the rest of the company and cast and crew, there's a certain element of earning confidence and trust there and communicating that and finding a way to do that, to dance that dance. I think with Kevin, I was very, Kevin and I have known each other for a long time. We've worked together a lot over the past sort of 15, 20 years. And I think that made it very, I think that is kind of the reason I got to make this film, really. Kevin was comfortable with me. We'd worked together a lot closely, both in theater and on feature films. When I came to him and told him I wanted to make this film, you know, having heard that he was doing this play and doing it with Sam and they were touring around the world, he responded very positively. He loved the idea, and I think he liked the idea of me doing it. So in terms of access, in terms of knowing Kevin well enough to know, you know, I mean, I think it'd be very different if I was somebody who had no relationship with him whatsoever and I turned up with cameras and was on the tour. I think that would have been a very different dynamic, and in a way, not just with Kevin, but I think with the rest of the company, just the slow unfolding of things, and this, you know, I was with them for so long. Me and my crew were with them for the best part of a year. I mean, 10 months, and so really over the as you know, in a way, these guys all, none of these guys knew each other beforehand. So they all came together from various different backgrounds and ages and experiences. Half of them were American, half of them were British. So I think us arriving into that as well sort of became part of the fabric and the glue, and everyone was on a process of sort of feeling everybody else out. So, you know, it could have gone horribly wrong, and definitely there were some of the actors who were more reticent and more reluctant to be filmed for the project than others. But over the course of time, I think, and I hope the film shows, you know, everyone really came together and supported the project and offered an awful lot and were very magnanimous and generous in their time with it.
Tell me about the chicken and egg aspect of this. I mean, what came first? Was it the idea that that he and Sam were going to do a play and mount it and then tour it around the world? Or was it the idea of to do a documentary about a play and then the play developed? I mean, what came first?
No, I mean, the play very much came first, and the film came as a result of them doing this. So it was something I wanted to document. So for that year and the 2 years previous, Sam had produced and directed in partnership with the Old Vic Theatre, Kevin's Theatre, and the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York. They had put together this thing called the Bridge Project. And the idea, I think, was, you know, Sam was a sort of British director living in the US. Kevin was an American actor living in the UK. They're both very deeply involved in theatre. They had this remarkably successful collaboration in film together before. And then I think with that and Sam's relationship with Joe Melillo at Brooklyn Academy of Music at BAM, the idea formed to sort of create this transatlantic theatre company who would open in London or in New York and close in the other city. And somewhere in between, tour it to the world and see if they could take it out and find partners around the world. And so that took place for the Richard III project was the third year of the Bridge project, and it was the final year. So there was already sort of an established way of doing it and touring in this way. And then when Sam and Kevin decided to do Richard III and take it around the world, they found, you know, other partners around the world to tour it to. So they visited, I think, 12 cities in total, you know, outside of London and New York. So very much, I mean, the thing that came first was this idea of Sam and Joe's and Kevin's to do the Bridge Project. And that had run for 2 years before Kevin did Richard III. And then when I knew he was doing that, I just was like, you know, for me, it felt like a kind of unique opportunity. My experience with Kevin at the Old Vic, you know, as an associate director there, as an assistant director there, you know, understanding the dynamic of a company and getting to know Kevin that well, and the Old Vic who I'd have to work with to make this film. So that combined with my sort of main career, which is in feature films and film work. So it felt to me like I had the insight and I had the access, I had the confidence in Kevin. And so if he could grant the access and we could raise money, this could be quite an interesting film on live theater. I'm not really hugely aware of many documentaries that go into the process of live theater, and certainly not a tour of this nature and of this scale, you know. Bruce Guthrie, the assistant director on the play, described it, you know, sort of as blockbuster theater. When you have someone like Kevin and someone like Sam and Shakespeare and you're touring it to all these places, it's not something that happens very often, sadly. And so to document that was the key that I brought to Kevin. And thankfully, we got to make this film.
Now, I'm thinking you could probably do an equally interesting film if you were to just document its initial production in whatever city it started in, London or New York, and with someone like Kevin and Sam, and you'd probably have enough material for a good 2-hour documentary right there. But then when you add the element of the touring, and then you have, you know, the exotic locations, you have them on the boat, you have them in Australia, you have them in where are they, in China? I mean, I'm trying to
China and the great, you know, in the desert, in the Saudi desert. I mean, it was quite a whirlwind. I mean, in some ways, this film, you know, is a kind of an adventure story on some level. You know, that aspect of it, you know, the sort of travel and the sort of adventure that they all went on. And so marrying that aspect of it with the theatre production and the story of the play and the story of this production coming together and growing and becoming what it was in front of audiences was sort of they're the two sort of poles, really, of the film that I tried to embroider together, you know.
Now, I would guess that if I was playing to – if I, being Mr. Media, was playing more towards a British or a UK audience, I'd probably be giving Gemma Jones more play here. She's obviously a very big star. Is not the focus of the film, but we, for American audiences, we get a good glimpse of her and a good sense of you know, how she manages to charm her audiences and the respect that so much of this cast held her in, right?
Well, I mean, you know, what Gemma, I mean, where do you even start? She is extraordinary. I think Chuck, or one of the British actors, is like, she's one step away from being a dame. And, you know, she really is. She's a beautiful and incredible individual, and then an extraordinarily talented and sort of generous and, you know, heartfelt actor, I think. She was just such an asset to the company in a whole, to the production, to in the theatre, to the work, but also, I think, as part of the family and a sort of, you know, this sort of brilliantly fun, sort of ribald, incredible sense of humour and brilliant sort of charm and energy that she brought to it. And, you know, and I hope we get a sense of that in the film. I mean, that was one of the things is, you know, whilst many people were hoping this would be a sort of Kevin Spacey expose or a film on Kevin, and it very much, there is that element to it. I really wanted to make this film about the company, and so throughout the film we get to meet everyone, and Gemma, you know, she's a star and always will be in her own right. I mean, she if she didn't have us all in stitches laughing, she had us all in shreds with her performance. She was quite a character, and as she mentions in the film, you know, she did a similar tour 40 years beforehand in the early 70s, you know, very, very successful and famous production of Peter Brook's Midsummer Night's Dream, which toured for 9 months around the world and was still today is very, very highly considered and a sort of groundbreaking production. So for her, you know, for the younger actors in the company, she was a huge character and figure. And yeah, Gemma, I mean, I miss her. She started off being very reticent and reluctant about me and pointing cameras and whatever the hell was going on. She didn't know. But I'm pleased to say that she melted a little bit, and I'm very glad to feel that she'd become a bit of a friend. She's someone I really respect and love a lot.
And a bit of a flirt too, when she tells the camera that she'd like to see that young man without his clothes on.
Oh yeah, no, she. I'm telling you, she is full of mischief. That lady, that girl. Mischief and humor, and definitely nonstop flirtation. It was. It's quite a joy to be around.
So, you're mounting a documentary that's going to take 10 months. Let's just call it a year. We'll give you the 2 months. How do you get funding for that? I mean, you're taking your crew. I assume you've got several people with you who are part of the documentary crew on top of the stage production, of course, and you're going to be touring. You're going to have to pay their expenses. On top of all the technical costs of mounting a documentary, you've got travel, you've got food, you've got all the stuff that's coming with them. Where do you get the money for that? Or did Kevin and Sam fund this, perhaps? Probably not.
Well, it was. I mean, the project, the genesis of the whole project, and actually getting it moving, getting people behind, and getting it funded. And, you know, you'd love to think that you flick a switch and here's an idea and let's go and do it. So, I mean, it's a slightly boring and complicated sort of journey. How the whole thing, and we sort of shot it and did it in stages, really. So there was a number of different budgets, and each time we'd move forward and almost like separate productions, you know. Yeah, early on, before there was really anything in place, any money or anything formal, you know, Kevin and Sam graciously allowed me into the rehearsal room for a couple of days, just me and my camera. It was right at about 2 months into the London run, before they went on tour and before they went Epidaurus, before financing got resolved and we budgeted and sort of cleared the sort of week shoot in Greece, which for me, for me, that really sort of pushed it, because I felt like if we couldn't get something greenlit and cleared for the week in Greece, to me, it felt like, you know, we were really losing a sort of backdrop and a context and a sort of part of the story that was really necessary. So thankfully, that imminence of that arriving sort of forced things to come together. And yeah, thankfully, we sort of bridged our way through and managed to pay for the whole thing. So it was a big part of the challenge, really, was to put these things together. Kevin was hugely instrumental in that and was hugely helpful and supportive and really got the ball rolling, I think, be fair to say.
What did you wind up spending to make the film?
Millions and millions of pennies. God, I mean, you know, I think details like that, you know, I think we did very well for the budget we had and all the countries and all of the tour, you know, all of what you see in the film. And it was also sort of a little bit of a fight from my point of view as director, but also as producer, to maintain a certain quality of shooting, so that we, you know, the ambition for me was always to make a film that would screen in theaters, that could go to film festivals, and would be a theatrical film about theater, as opposed to, you know, just television or internet. I kind of wanted to try and give it some of that sort of cinematic, sort of theatrical scale and scope and quality, really. So, yeah, I'm not going to throw any real figures out at you, but I'm very pleased with we came in under budget. I'm very pleased with what we got for what we spent.
Were there members of the cast who were planning to be in the stage production who may have backed out when they found out about the documentary nature?
No, there was no one. I mean, I think by the time they found out about the documentary production, it was too late. They were already in the play. So, but I don't think anyone felt that strongly about it. I think everyone, understandably, people were a little bit, what's this and what's the angle and what's it for and all of those things. And, you know, I hope that my crew and I approached that sensitively and sort of, you know, found a way through it. But there was never really any protests out there. And I think once people met us and understood where we were coming from and understood that we were trying to tell a story about theater, and it was sort of, in a way, this film, I see it for me, you know, having spent 3 years at the Ulvik Theater as part of the company, for me, this is a bit of a love letter to theater. It's a little bit of a, you know, it's a very positive and affirmative film about the process and the craft and the hard work and effort and the family and the company that goes into making it. So I think people understood that, you know, eventually, and sort of got on board, you know, and I'm really pleased with that. I'm really pleased with the film. It doesn't have a cynical bone in its body. It's not salacious. It's not trying to get out there and be some sort of, you know, prod people and make fights happen. And I think once the cast and crew, who are already exhausted touring around the world doing this work, understood that, then they kind of relaxed a little bit, and it wasn't so much of an issue.
Was there anyone who shown more in the documentary than they did in the actual stage production? Anyone whose personality, for example, came out for you that maybe they were not as prominent in the actual production of Richard III, but they made a bigger impression actually in the documentary?
Well, I mean, in a way, yeah. In the film, you know, there's sort of two – you're sort of moving through two timelines simultaneously. And there's sort of two stories being told simultaneously. One is the audience arriving and the curtain call, you know, and we sort of travel through one night of the play, essentially, with the company in the theater doing that work. And so that's part of the journey. And then the other sort of timeline is the tour over the course of a year, where they start out in London and they finish in New York and everything in between. So it was what we did in the film. I mean, there's so many stories to tell. And the truth is, every single one of those company members, you know, was a remarkable, it was kind of an embarrassment of riches for a documentary filmmaker. They were just remarkable company people. And so they all shone beautifully and brilliantly in their own way throughout the tour and each night on stage in whatever role they were playing. I think for the film's purposes and in trying to sort of tell all these stories, what we did is really, you know, the arc of the company is the arc of the year-long tour, you know. And then there's a few characters like Gemma or Kevin or one or two others whose work on stage we explore a little bit more, Annabelle, Scully's another, you know. It was just such an interesting tapestry to try and cross-connect, really, the individual human being with the character they were playing, the adventure they're on through the year with the company, how that's all working, and then the story they each, the ritual and routine they each go through the night, every night of the play. So really, you know, whether it be Kevin or Sam or the cast, here's me turning up to this collection of remarkable storytellers, really, trying to convince them to let me tell their story. And I felt a sort of huge burden of, responsibility in that. You know, someone like Sam, Kevin, Shakespeare, you know, all these amazingly talented and brilliant people. So that was a big sort of, it was very important for me that I not only represented their work, you know, fairly in the right way, but that actually also represented them as people. And so, you know, so each of the cast members, whether it's Gavin, who's, you know, sort of young, possibly the youngest in the company, to Gemma and Maureen, who are at the other end of the spectrum, you know, to try and give everyone a chance to be themselves in the film and to sort of get to know them a little bit in the film and their part in this sort of remarkable Rubik's Cube of characters and talents that Sam had sort of woven together for the tour. I hope they all are happy with the film. I think they are. And some of the nicest compliments from them is that they really felt that the film kind of somehow captured the essence of what they were as a company and the experiences they had on the tour.
Well, and of course, if they didn't like the film, they still got to walk away with a replica of themselves as a bobblehead, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, but thankfully, I mean, none of them have told me that they didn't like the film. I think I've had, you know, maybe there's a few of them, but there you go, yeah.
And so now you know that I watched all the way through to the end. So obviously, you've got the 3 years on your resume at the Old Vic as associate director. I'm sure you have more theatrical experience beyond that, you know, live theater. Did you bring a bucket list to this documentary, the things that you wanted to really capture in the wings of a live production, and you know, what were some of those, and what were some that you just weren't able to capture, if there were any?
Really, you know, I mean, one of the things that was very important to me was that this film and the people in it and the work, you know, that I got out of the way, and that it sort of spoke for itself. So the things that I wanted, that I felt were important from my experience and from my as a director, and sort of the stories that I was interested in telling that were sort of the less apparent stories, the sort of wider themes, which were really kind of the biggest challenge, I think, to try and make into a film. One was that notion of these 20 plus people who don't know each other coming together, and by the end of the journey they're on, sort of forming this sort of company. My own experience of being in a theatre company had lent me to see when it works, and it doesn't always work, but when it works, it's quite a special thing. And amazingly, this company really were a shining example of that. The other thing that was really, I really wanted to try and find a way to express in the film, but slightly across purposes to even making a film, is the sort of power of live theater. I mean, why do people go into these halls or these theaters, sit in front of a stage and watch this stuff play out? What is it about that experience that is different to film or playing a PlayStation or doing something on your phone? Like, why is that so compelling? And why is it really one of the most sort of, you know, fundamental art forms that we have? So that idea of trying to communicate the moment of theater, that the liveness of the fact that this is happening, this story is playing out from under your eyes in flesh and blood, once only in the moment. And because of that, I think Sam describes it very well in the film, but because of that, when you're there with it, you know you're seeing this for the one time only, and you're sort of, the experience is richer and heightened because of it. And I think that potency of live theater, when it works, when it all comes together, which can, you know, we've all had the experiences of sort of, you know, numb bums on the seat, but when it does come together, which I think it did in this production, it's quite a special experience for the audience. So to try in a film to communicate that was one of the big sort of goals for me on this film. But yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, you did not want it to make it just a film about Kevin Spacey on stage, and obviously there's plenty of other people and other storylines throughout and things going on. But I suspect because Kevin is a big star, obviously it's the name that's drawing people to watch the documentary, was there a lot of stuff left on the cutting room floor? What are we missing on the cutting room floor that would further charm us or engage us about Kevin Spacey? What kind of moments did we not get to see, just, you know, for time reasons, for example?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so much that goes into editing something like this together, and there were so, like, the edit was, I knew it was going to be such a huge part of it, and ended up working with a remarkable editor, Wills Nadarek, to sort of do the final edit on this film. And we shot a lot of footage. I mean, we were traveling for a year. Every night at the theater, there's this sort of repeated ritual, and we're capturing elements of that, you know, each of the different cities, the backdrops of this, you know, and then in the actors alone, I think we did two interviews with almost each one of the cast and then some of the crew. And that in itself is like 50 or 60 hours of material. So there was a lot of stories to be told, you know, countries, theaters, characters, individuals, Shakespeare, the play itself, you know, all of those things to be told. So to try and, you know, and in some ways, like when we were creating this edit, myself and Will, we saw it as a bit of a multifaceted gem. I mean, one minute you're backstage in the middle of a scene and somebody's walking on stage, the next minute you're, you know, you're on the Great Wall of China. So to be able to dance between all of these elements of the stories was a really a beautiful piece of editing, I think, from Will's point of view. What was left out? There was a couple of lovely, there was so many things, you know, so difficult. Always for a director, you have these things you love, these moments that you really want to tell, but for whatever reason in all of the other stories and the connection. So there are some lovely sort of, I guess, deleted scenes or extras that are available. I think they're available with the DVD if you buy the DVD. And I also believe if you download the film, which is on nowthefilm.com, you can download these. It's probably about 45 minutes of extra stuff. And there's one that I love in particular, which is just about the company. And it's sort of, again, it tells that story. There's one on Kevin, one on Sam. But if there was a moment in the whole endeavor that isn't in the film that I could put in the film, God, I don't know. There's so many, it's impossible to say, really. You know, there's countless moments. There's also countless moments that we never caught on film. You know, I remember very early on thinking, you know, if I could edit the conversations I'm having and the things that I've sort of seen, this film would be remarkable. Because, of course, you're off duty and you're having a drink with someone and you're chatting and but I think all of that plays into when you do eventually sit down in your interviews. But yeah, that was somebody should invent that for documentary filmmakers. Just like, I don't know, whatever it is that you could download your memories and what you've heard and seen and cut them together. It'd be quite an interesting process, I suspect.
Well, Jeremy, this is going to sound silly, but could you turn profile to your right for just a second? Yeah. Okay, folks, I'd just like to get some feedback via email. Does anyone else think that Jeremy, when he turns with the green hat and the beard, looks a little like a young Fidel Castro? That's all. So, sorry. It's
kind of, no, it's all good.
You'll see the video later, and maybe you'll see why I asked that.
I'm a huge fan of Cuba and rum and the odd cigar, so why not?
There you go. Maybe we just get you a – well, anyway. So you've got this done. This is out, and we'll tell people in a minute where they can get the film and see it. What's next for you? What do you got up next? What are you doing?
This is out. We had a great run in cinemas with Now, and it's great. I think it's coming to Netflix soon. Beginning of February, it's available on Netflix. So I encourage you all to check it out. I'm really hoping people will see it on Netflix as well. And you know, those fans of House of Cards as well. It's sort of another Netflix world. But next, I'm actually speaking to me in Mexico. I'm here at the moment, sort of over the past 2 years, between the sort of cracks of Now and that project, which took most of my attention. I've been working on a project down here and various other sort of parts of the world, which is it's a film about what I'm encountering as a sort of emerging sort of global community and a sort of global consciousness, really, against the backdrop of a world in increasing crisis. So it's a project that sort of, in some ways, reflects a lot of what was in Now. I'm looking at the festival world. And various festivals around the world, huge, big kind of tribal gatherings like Glastonbury in London or in UK, in Glastonbury, UK, or Burning Man, smaller festivals around the place. And there's a sort of Burning Man in Nevada in the US, a number of others. There's another festival next month which I'm supposed to go on. The idea of these sort of conscious festivals and these places, the project's title is Sacred and Profane. And what I'm encountering is inside of these worlds is a community of people emerging who really have a certain shorthand, who sort of acknowledge and recognize. I think it's something that I'm encountering reflected in everyone I speak to. I'm sure you can relate to it yourself. I mean, I think the veils are slipping somewhat on sort of organized religion and the sort of economic crash and what the hell is actually going on anymore. And so I'm exploring communities and cultures and people who are looking for other ways to play the game, really. I'm currently in Mexico. Part of that story for me is what the ancient Maya had to say on the whole thing in their stone and in their calendars down in Mexico. So I've been exploring that since 2012, and that's led me then into these festivals and this sort of, you know, international community that seemed to be increasingly conscious, increasingly aware, and increasingly sort of evident. I mean, it's amazing to me. I've been a huge fan of I've been very interested in sort of I guess some people call it perennial philosophy or sort of ancient wisdom, really, for a long, long time. And it's very interesting to me how many, you know, I used to bore people with it for years, and now every other person I meet is sort of full of questions and fascinated by it. So exploring that and meeting some extraordinary people doing it, and the project is sort of beginning to take shape. Now that Now is done, I have a little bit of time to really focus on that and edit. So that's what I'm working on at this very moment, a few other things going on.
But. So will you call the new film Then?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, possibly. I think it'll actually have a lot of similar themes and a lot of similar resonances, but actually it'll be a very different film, and it'll be exploring a very different world, really. But I haven't quite come up. The working title is The Sacred and the Profane. So the idea that you can have this, like, sort of on the surface, sort of madly hedonistic, sort of party world, but yet within it, somehow it brings everyone closer together, sort of similar to a theater company, in a way that there is a sort of understanding and acceptance and acknowledgement of everyone's sort of more sacred side, you know, and there's a sort of spiritual, weirdly, this combination of sort of festival and party and spirituality is something that's very interesting to me.
Well, when you're done and it's out in release, come back. Talk to us about it.
We'd love to. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Smoovy.
All right. And folks,
it's been good to see you. And next time I'll bring a Havana cigar from Cuba.
You do that. I'm sure you're in Mexico. I'm sure you have access to them now. Folks, you can see Jeremy Wheelahan's new documentary, Now, in the Wings on a World Stage on Netflix by the time this airs. Or you can also order it right now. You can download it on Amazon, or you can order it as a DVD from Amazon right through Mr. Media. If you're watching us on MrMedia.com, either to the left or to the right, if you look, you'll see the cover of the DVD for Now, and you can click on it and have it instantly as a download. Or I understand they can get it to you in 30 minutes or less via drone. So, you know, you got that. Jeremy, is there a website for the film or for your production company?
Yeah, you can find the film and the trailer, and you can download it as well from nowthefilm.com. You'll find me and my work at treetopsproductions.com. So either of those.
And are you a Twitter or Facebook guy? Can people find you on social media?
Yeah, to Facebook, sort of work Facebook is Treetops Productions also. There's also Now the Film on Facebook, at Now the Film on Twitter, and I'm there as well, Jeremy Whelan, at Jeremy Whelan on Twitter as well. If you want to come and say hello, I'll be here.
Very good. Well, Jeremy Whelan, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today, and really enjoyed the film. I hope other people will as well.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased you did, and it's been lovely talking to you. I'm wondering where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at buzzburbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com, the George and Tony Entertainment Show from the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lil Melser crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk, and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.